each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey, God bless you for tuning in to The Winds Have Changed. Father Tom Coyce here. Oh, that's the reward room. We have the door open right at the beginning of the show. Well, that means, and there's the reward. Though, Nick, I think we need it. There's the reward room. The reward room seems to indicate that the reward is money. So we might have to fine-tune that a little bit there because, anyways, God love you. I'm Father Tom Coyce. Here on a Wednesday, it is the feast of St. Ignatius of Loyola. Today's, now you know, it is the feast of St. Ignatius. And so we got to go to one of my favorite episodes in history that is a somewhat lost episode because, how shall we say, I don't know if it's holy forgetfulness or holy unforgetfulness, you know? You know how I like to share things in history? And I think it's very important as you do history, you need to know the virtue of holy forgetfulness versus unholy forgetfulness. First, you need to remember things. That's learning and remembering things. There's a lot of things we don't know, especially about the past. But as you look at history, we need to know what happened before us because, I use that beautiful line from last week when I was with you, and I think it was last week when I shared some thoughts from Dr. Robert Dolahide's beautiful book. He was a physician doctor here in this Chicago area, great Catholic person and family and all. And he says wisely, as he shares his story about his life, he says, we all begin our stories in the midst of stories that are already in progress. We all begin our stories in the midst of stories that are already in progress. That's a good way to enter into history, good way to want to learn more about history. So anyway, since today's the feast of St. Ignatius, the founder of the Jesuits, we need to go back to that chapter in history known as the Jesuit Suppression. You may not even know that the Jesuits were suppressed. Suppressed. Oh, yeah.
Hello there, Peabody here.
I thought you might show
up.
Once
again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
Well, let's just say the time before the American Revolution, all right? Everybody kind of knows the American Revolution was in 1776. The last part of the 18th century. So this happens, the Jesuit suppression happens in the, shall we say, 1750s and 60s. Yeah.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Those are brain-wrinkling thoughts. We're going to get to more brain-wrinkling thoughts. There's a bunch of characters that we're going to have to investigate and bring to light. But this this was going on in Europe, of course, because it was the Pope that suppressed the Jesuits. And it's an amazing, fascinating story that we have to learn from. And especially because I believe today, the Jesuits today are, in a sense, under a spell. They're under. So this will be a challenge to any of my Jesuit friends or any of those of you who have many Jesuit friends or have gone to Jesuit institutions, something like Ignatius of Loyola, the Ignatius High School or Loyola University, as it were. There's Bellarmine Retreat Center, all these things here in the Chicagoland area, but they're scattered throughout the United States as well, of course. But I believe they're under a spell, it's my purpose in this wonderful hour of brain wrinkling, winds of change, to number one, offer the Jesuits a kind of a olive branch, number one, offer them a somewhat of an olive branch, number two, slap them around a little bit. In other words, hopefully open their eyes to some mistakes that are pandemic, it seems like, in a lot of the Jesuit communities. And number three, offer the way to a better future. How's that for a challenge, as it were? What I'm talking about, the reason...
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, it does wrinkle my brain. What I'm referring to is the Jesuit suppression, which happened back in the 1700s, was so devastating, as it were, to that community founded by St. Ignatius back in the 1500s primarily to defend Catholicism against the Protestant Reformation. That's primarily what St. Ignatius... was trying to do, and he made a lot of great inroads. Then all of a sudden the attention of the world shifted to the New World, America and South America and what have you, and the Jesuits were extremely great missionaries. As Europe lit up into the religious wars following the Reformation because of the Reformation, that's a perspective that most students of history would probably never even hear that in your history class. Why was the modern world of Europe plagued with wars? Because of the wrong-headedness of Martin Luther and his followers, which were Minion. So we're going to, as we jump to the 1700s, we find that the Pope, let me go back here to see the Pope Clement the Pope Clement the 14th, okay? Pope Clement the 14th. Don't know how I could just remember that. Sometimes I try to hook a memory. I'm using this memory device to help you, my listeners, too, because you go through all this church history and one pope runs into another. And there's so many with so many names. We got Clement the 14th, so that means there were 13 Pope Clements before them. It's kind of hard to keep it all straight. So 14, when I think of 14, I think of Ernie Banks. Okay, sorry, I'm a Cubs fan. But Ernie Banks was definitely not a vicious baseball player, whereas we might say that Pope Clement the 14th was a bad pope. As a matter of fact, Warren Carroll, in his great five-volume series on Christendom, on history of our church and our faith, history of the modern world, or even in the ancient world, anyways, he calls Pope Clement the 14th the last bad pope. And there were series now. There's a lot of maybe some competition for that. And I say that as a loyal Catholic who believes in the papacy, believes in hierarchy, believes in even infallibility as it came to be defined later in the late 1800s, Vatican Council I. But anyways, how did an organization that started to defend Catholicism in the face of the attacks of Protestantism become suppressed by the Pope, who considered the Jesuits sort of the fifth arm of the army, or fifth column, sometimes it's called, what have you. So we got to, we're going to see this, and the fact, here's what I'm going to put this in context, then we got to go back and put the pieces together just to know the history. And of course, the history will include many episodes and many examples where bad romances ruined history. I think that's it's a very important topic for us today.
Oh, no!
Yeah, that man-woman relationship is something we automatically think of as just private and individual, and has no effect on the world stage. But when you look at world history and you look at the great movements therein, you very often find bad romantic relationships gone sour, as it were. So it's an injunction for all of you who treasure and try to advance and solidify, deepen your marriage, your relationships, especially if you're planning to get married or you are married, that's a very, very important aspect of your life, to try to do the best you can for one another, so that relationship won't go sour, so that World War III or IV or V won't happen. A little bit radical? Yeah, I guess it is, but that's how we see things oftentimes, especially when you step back. The fact that the Jesuits were suppressed back in the mid-1700s, and that they were brought back, fairly soon, right after the United States became the United States. Not that the founding of the United States had much to do with it. It certainly America and the New World had a lot to do with Europe, and vice versa. What was going on in Europe had a lot to do with what was going on in the New World, and the New World influenced much of what was going on in Europe. We don't think of that so quickly, but we should keep that in mind. The Jesuits brought back are still suffering from authority slap. I think this is a disease, or this is a trauma that almost all of us could relate to. When you are very dedicated to your authority figure, and that authority figure slaps you down, that has a deep and profound effect on you. As a matter of fact, being slapped down by someone you don't look up to as an authority figure in your life doesn't affect you much at all. It sometimes will give you great stamina to continue, right? So this is what I want all my Jesuit friends to consider, and all those who don't have a certain skepticism about Jesuits in the world today. And of course, generalizations have their exceptions, and there's, I'm talking about a trend or a generalization. Individual people may not fit the generalization or the trend, but by and large, there's a trend in the Jesuits of today that needs to be questioned, that needs to be analyzed from a critical standpoint. So what the Jesuits of today are suffering from is this authority slap syndrome. That's a good terminology. You got to come up with an acronym, right? Authority slap syndrome. They're suffering from...
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, there we go. They're suffering from ASS. Uh-oh, sorry about that. But anyways, the authority slap syndrome is when your authority slaps you down. You come back, and you're not going to, you're not going to make the same mistake twice, as it were. In a similar sense, the way I see a lot of the religious women, sisters, are operating today. Religious sisters, especially those that are older, and that's most of them, I guess you could say today, the older religious sisters remember years gone by when they were very much a part of the catechetical training of young Catholics in schools, of course. They had that reputation of being very strict. And in the modern world, with Vatican II coming along, they got slapped down. And so they're like living under this same authority slap syndrome, ASS, and that will keep them from making the same mistake twice in their minds. Well, that's the parameter. That's the general thesis, and we're going to go back. We'll go back to see what started all this. Man. Yeah, okie doke. I'm Father Tom Coyes. You're listening to Listener Supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Will you say yes? Our Lady is looking for patrons. In 1999, the Blessed Mother asked the St. Stanislaus Kostka Parish, open the doors. And so we did. St. Stanislaus Kostka Parish is now open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, providing all people a place of prayer, a quiet sanctuary from the noise of the world to adore the living God and hear His voice. In 2007, Francis Cardinal George designated St. Stanislaus Kostka the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy for Chicago. Since that time, we have been faithful to the call to be a place of spiritual sanctuary for those seeking God and His mercy. The cost of keeping our doors open 24 hours a day is considerable, to say nothing of the cost of maintaining this beautiful and historic church in the heart of Chicago. We are asking you to consider becoming a patron of the Blessed Mother, promising God and the Blessed Mother a weekly donation of $20 or more for at least 1 year to support the call to open the doors. As a patron, you will know that you have answered Our Lady's call to keep the doors open, and be remembered at Patrons' Masses on the second Sunday of the month at St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy. Will you accept Our Lady's invitation and join the Patrons of the Blessed Mother? Go to ststandschurch.org, that's ststandschurch.org, and click on the Donations tab, and click Patron on the drop-down. God bless you.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
And now, some Byzantine spirituality from Father Tom Loya. Let's drop in on Father Tom as he counsels a single mom.
Yes, come in. Come in. Have a seat. What can I do for you? You're feeling burned out, okay? Frustrated. Your son won't listen to you. You can't discipline him. It's difficult being a single mom. I know, I understand. Well, listen, Mom. Stop trying to be father for him. Stop trying to discipline him. Stop trying to do for him what only his father can do, or a man can do. He needs to be put around things that have to do with the male world, good mentors. You can't give him what only dad can give him. Okay, dad's not around. I realize that. That's unfortunate. But he has to be turned over to the male world. See, a boy, when he reaches around teenagehood, has to be turned over to the male world to become a man. There's something that the mother cannot give him, that only the father can give him, or other positive male role models. But Mom, there is something very valuable that you can give him. Your image and modeling of authentic femininity. See, he needs that, like a touchstone. As he learns to be a man, he needs to know what real womanhood is. And that's what you can model for him. Let's make an appointment and talk more about this next week.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. God bless you for tuning in. Hey, that was a neat little ad there with our ad, or it's not really an ad, but the little clip about Father Thomas Loya and counseling a single mom. The interplay between men and women is fundamental, my friends, and we're gonna see how it came into a play with, of course, the history of the Jesuit suppression. That's what we're talking about here today. Before I do that again, I don't want to let the idea pass that during this week we are praying something that's again a little bit new in the church. It's quite popular in a lot of parts of the world, but it's not too popular here in the Midwest, as it were. But there's a movement in the church to declare a new holy day, or at least a new feast day. Since it would be on a Sunday, it wouldn't be a new holy day of obligation. And that is a feast of God, the Father of all mankind. It's very beautiful. It's a beautiful thought. And there's a devotion that goes along with it, prayers. It's called an octave. It's not a novena of prayers. Novena of prayers is 9 days. But this is 8 days from a Sunday to a Sunday. So you got 7 days, and then you consecrate yourself to God, the Father of all mankind. It's very beautiful. I love it because it has a very good catechesis, not only for Catholics, but if non-Catholics were to listen and pray those prayers, you would find yourself being supported. If you were a Jewish person, you'd be supported in your Jewish faith, especially as it's rooted in the Old Testament, of course. If you were a Protestant Christian, you'd find yourself supported in all the good things of the Protestant spirituality. But you would see that the progression, the salvation history that God has accomplished through millennia is pointing all in the direction of Catholicism. Now Catholicism is such a capstone of salvation history. And so as you pray these prayers, the one thing, I was talking with some of the people in my parish, we prayed I guess you can call it a chaplet. There is a kind of a rosary-like bead thing, but it doesn't have 5 decades of 10 beads each. It has 8 decades of 8 beads each, so you can't really call it a decad, could you? It's the octave, eight little prayers, and it's a beautiful way to put yourself trusting in God the Father, who is deeper and the ultimate goal of our pilgrimage. To come back to to recreate our Father's house that has been lost by sin, and know that our ultimate destiny is to be with God our Father in heaven, ultimately, of course. Anyways, it's a beautiful devotion. I'll have to talk more about it. So getting back to the Jesuit expression, because today is the Feast of St. Ignatius, and I'm putting a challenge out there to my Jesuit friends and those who are either enamored by the Jesuits and find them the great leading light of the church today. Need to issue a challenge in the sense that if certain problems within the Jesuit community are not appreciated, our problems will get worse within the church. I'll put it that way. So I was making a comparison between the authority slap syndrome that the Jesuits unconsciously, I don't think this is a conscious thing, but unconsciously are living under, similar to the, shall we say, the more liberal, progressive, religious women. before the break, I was starting to say that most elderly religious women remember the days when they were teaching in Catholic schools. And unfortunately, many of the Catholics that went through those schools contributed to the present problem because many of the students that went through Catholic schools with sisters that were strict quickly pointed out or are glad to point out the terror, the reign of terror that those sisters sometimes exercised in their classrooms. I feel it's a very unfair criticism because you're talking about a 25-year-old young woman who's newly professed in a religious order in charge of a classroom full of 60 children. You had to have incredible discipline, and you had to nip things in the bud, as we sometimes will say. So anyways, but they quickly learned that, and I'm sure they probably admitted sincerely, we did go overboard with certain kinds of discipline and strictness. And so in the post-Vatican II time, they were kind of ridiculed or slapped down, not by the Pope, but by their constituents, by their people. And so many of the religious sisters, I know they didn't take an official vow, but and they may not even know this consciously as well, but I'm going to point it out, and if there are any elderly religious sisters listening, I'd love to hear from you, and shoot me an email, by all means. That goes for all listeners, too, actually. You know, you could remember, I have a crazy little email address, unlikeothernations@gmail.com. I do hear from people from time to time, and it's wonderful to hear that. It's good to enter into a dialogue in one way or another. So, but the sisters that were slapped down by their reputation of being too strict sort of took they live under a kind of vow never to do that again. We're not going back there again. We're not going to slap anyone's knuckles. We're not going to appear like we're mean and vicious. They tried to correct that reputation by being very compassionate, whoa, very understanding.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, that's an important realization. I do believe it's accurate. So they became a kind of a. So it's very much of what it is sometimes referred to as the watering down of Catholicism. We're not going to be too strict about getting things right or memorizing commandments or precepts of the church or prayers and all the rest, because that was part of the old regime of being too strict. Something very similar, I believe, is a reason why the Jesuits today have a kind of a parallel approach to pastoral work and all the rest, because they were slapped down by the Pope. And why were they slapped down? That's what we got to get back to. So let's go to history here again. So we're talking about, here's a number of the characters that are involved. Some of the kings and queen, and some of the popes that are involved, okay? So if you got your scorecards out, we're talking with primarily one of the important ones was King Joseph in Portugal. There was a king at the time, 1750, okay, a little bit before the American Revolution. King Joseph of Portugal. Then we have King Louis the 15th in France. King Louis the 15th in France was notoriously promiscuous. He became king of France when he was 5 years old and was somewhat of a terror around the royal palace and got whatever he wanted. You can imagine a little kid growing up people waiting on him hand and foot, as it were, literally, even wiping his butt, shall we say. These kinds of things were a part of the royal lifestyle, so he became quite immoral and promiscuous. He had a relative that was king of France, actually. So we got King Charles III in France, who is the grandson of Louis XIV, which is the father of Louis XV of France. So you got this French connection dominating Portugal and Spain. Then you can throw in King George III. King George III, of course, us Americans know very well. And if you're if you like listening to musicals and you listen to Hamilton, you will hear undoubtedly the portrayal of King George III. He comes out as the one big bad guy in the story of Hamilton. Most American colonists would have agreed that King George III of England was one of the bad guys because he was trying to stamp out the establishment of the American Republic, of course. Then we can throw in Queen Catherine. There was a queen in Germany at the time. Germany wasn't Germany that we know it today, but the conglomeration of states roughly associated with the Holy Roman Empire. But because the Protestant Reformation did its damage, so to speak, there was pockets of Protestant Germany and pockets of Catholic Germany. So Queen Catherine comes into play in the story of the Jesuits as well. She happens to be the great-grandmother of Joseph Stalin of communist fame and fortune, or infamy, shall we say. One thing that was all...
Wow.
Okay, yeah, the brain...
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, time, when you look across times, you see things the way we train our children and our parents influence us, of course. But one thing that was common in all these civil leaders, government leaders, monarchs, is they all desired a state church. A state church, not because they wanted the church to guide the state. You could sort of say, if you are in favor of a state church, it's because you love that church so much that you are willing to make your society in which you rule over conform with that religion. That's a mistaken view. They wanted a church state, not because they love religion so much, but because they knew it was powerful and they knew it had popularity with people, it had influence, and it gave meaning to many of their subjects. So they wanted a church state so that they could control the church. So these monarchs had that idea going in mind, and because, even though they're Catholic, they were Catholic, well, except King George III of there, and Queen Catherine from Germany was also not Catholic, but they all had this sense of they wanted a church state. The popes that we're talking about in this time are, let's see, get your scorecard out. We got one Benedict, two Clements, and two Piuses. First was Benedict the 14th. So when Benedict the 15th came around, well, we had just recently B16, Benedict the 16th, which of course now our living Pope Emeritus. But two Benedicts before him was Pope Benedict the 14th. So he was first. He ruled, he was Pope from 1740 to 58. 1740 to 1758. So 18 years. Pretty long papacy for Benedict the 14th. Then we get Clement the 13th. Clement the 13th was from 1758 to 1769, so getting a little closer to the Declaration of Independence of Thomas Jefferson fame. Okay, he actually died as a confessor. He wasn't a martyr by beheading him, having his head chopped off, but Pope Clement the 13th was tortured so much and beaten by the the French rulers, the henchmen of the French king, that he died of his wounds. That's the technical term for what a confessor is. Every now and then at Mass, if you go to Mass, you might hear the distinction between kinds of saints. And, of course, there's a martyr who is killed for not denying the faith in one way or another, like Thomas More had his head chopped off. St. Peter, St. Paul, all those are martyrs, of course. And we have red as the color. Then there are doctors of the church, like St. Teresa of Avila and Thomas Aquinas. Those are like great teachers of the church. But there's a category of saints called confessors. And for a long time, whenever I saw that, I thought, they must have been like great confessors, like St. John Vianney or Padre Pio, right? You know, these two saints that read souls and were great confessors and had people come to them for. But that's not the definition of a confessor saint. A confessor saint is someone who does die, but more like from his wounds, or he's put in prison and dies in prison. So that's the technical definition of a confessor saint. And that's what Pope Clement XIII was. He was very upset at this movement to try to put down the Jesuits that was inspired by many of the merchants and monarchs of Europe at the time. So then we get Pope Clement XIV, and Pope Clement XIV is the one who signs the Order of Suppression. And that happened in 1773, 3 years right before Thomas Jefferson signs the Declaration of Independence, okay? And then we get Pope Pius VI, again, was a kind of a confessor. He was a virtual martyr, and he really was trying to defend the Jesuits, even though they were still suppressed, and he wasn't able to unsuppress them just yet. Pope Pius VII, then, he goes all the way up into 1823. He was put in jail by Napoleon and the French Revolution, and what happened after that. Some called him, they thought he'd be the last pope, Pope Pius VII. Okay, so here we go. What do we got? We can set the stage for this Jesuit suppression because they were so successful in the New World, meaning South America, Mexico, North America. It was a two-edged sword. They were successful converting the Indians, and they were also good confessors. They were often named as monarchs' confessors. And by that means, I mean the one that the king or queen or prince or duke or marquis or any of the noble family would go to confession to. They'd be like a spiritual director, okay? So there's these two aspects of the Jesuits, and they were very successful. Why was being successful in converting Indians in the New World, why did that work against the Jesuits? Because many of the other people in the New World from Europe were there primarily for get rich quick schemes. Like, hey, this is, we call it an emerging market. And if you follow stocks and bonds and what have you today, where should you put your money? Oh, if there's an emerging market, that's oftentimes a great place to put your money. And so anyways, obviously they're finding a lot of resources, gold and silver and what have you. And so that the Jesuits were making Catholics of them made it more difficult to make slaves of them and treat them like human beings. Many of the European merchants, again, this is before the American colonists, the history of the New World starts more in South America and Mexico than it does in North America. There is something going on up there, but this Spain and Portugal were obviously dominating South America and Mexico. And they made a lot more advances earlier than the Europeans who were colonizing North America. There's some of the stage set again, and we're going to see how this plays out. And again, remember, I'm relating the story because I think it has a big effect on what's going on in the church today, especially with the watering down of the faith or the fear of being a strong defender of what the church has taught. Is teaching and needs to teach, okay? So we'll be right back. I'm Father Tom Coyes. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stan's School has an amazing PK 3 through 8th grade program focused on leadership and social-emotional learning and is one of the only schools to implement the Reading and Writing Project of Columbia University and the University of Chicago. Everyday math across the board, PK 3 through 8th, is taught by our highly educated and dedicated teachers. St. Stan's students are academically challenged with advanced level placement opportunities as their test scores and high school admissions speak volumes. St. Stan's is an integral part of the Wicker Park community where you feel welcome and at home with other families and friends who enjoy the same warm, friendly, and safe atmosphere for their children. We have small classroom size, which makes a difference in the whole learning experience. Many schools have excellent programs. At St. Stan's, we empower students to be excellent. Join the St. Stan's family. It is a selective admissions process. Grades 1 through 8 are tested and interviewed. Call 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560. Or stop by at 1255 North Noble Street. That's one block north of Division, just off the Kennedy. More information at ststanschicago.org. That's ststanschicago.org.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
There is a lot going on at St. Stan's. St. Stanislaus Koska is the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. There is Eucharistic adoration before the iconic monstrance, confessions 4 days per week, and masses in English, Polish, and Spanish. There's much more waiting for you here. St. Stan's is right off the Kennedy Expressway, just two blocks north of Division on Noble. Find out more by going to ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org and enter into the presence of Christ.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. A little jaunt into history here as we celebrate the feast of St. Ignatius. And I'm talking about the episode in the history of their lives called the Jesuit suppression. Something that is not very well known, but it has a deep effect, and I'm proposing that its effects are still operative in the Jesuits' communities of today. They were suppressed under Pope Clement XIV, and eventually brought back. So I'm trying to analyze why were they suppressed? And the fact that you are slapped down by an authority figure, you usually come back very timid, especially, of course, if that authority figure is still in play. You're not going to get slapped down a second time, even if you were right and the authority figure was wrong. That's the key factor. And in this sense, the Jesuits were definitely right at that time, and Pope Clement XIV was definitely wrong. He was following the wrong advice. He was worried about the wrong things. So let's put the pieces together a little bit. So Portugal, under King Joseph, was the first to expel the Jesuits. Jesuits were having too much success with baptizing the Indians, and that was making it hard for the slave masters to treat the Indians like slaves. And so he says, no Jesuits in Portugal, and get them out of Brazil and Paraguay. Also, Paraguay is a landlocked nation in South America. not too far. I'm not exactly sure where the Amazon Synod is going to take place. That is so much in the news today, if you're aware of that. Pope Francis I, our present pontiff, wants to have a synod called the Amazon Synod. And there was a document that came out as a working document to try to help us to get focus the agenda on the Amazon Synod. And it's filled with all sorts of environmentalism and New Age. It's the only way to say it. It's filled with New Age type theology. And also it's one of the kingpin issues is should we allow priests to marry so that they can minister to the people of the Amazon jungles. Cardinal Mueller from Germany, as well as a few others here in the United States too, not too many have spoken up against that idea. But I think we should put these kinds of things that are going on today in the context of history and see how it is so clear. It's very easy to see how Pope Clement the 14th made a mistake, and those cardinals who were defending the Jesuits back in those early days were in the right, and how Clement the 14th was in the wrong. So it's a crazy conclusion to come out with, but it can and it should give us confidence to analyze what's going on in the church today. And every criticism of someone in the hierarchy is not necessarily an abandonment of your faith. It might very well be a profession of your faith today. I say that as a kind of as a faithful conservative type Catholic, and it's a little hard for me to say that. But a lot of my liberal progressive Catholic friends have been very comfortable saying that for the past 40, 50 years. Now in a certain sense, the shoe's on the other foot with Pope Francis and some of the things that he's been ambiguously promoting, shall we say. We'll just leave it at that for now. The Portugal was getting upset with those the emerging markets. And not only that, of course, it's money and what else? Money and sex. You knew it would come around to that somehow. We're going to go back. Let's see. The year 1757, King Joseph of Portugal, he had one of his ministers, a guy by the name of Pombal. He was sort of the right-hand man, the minister of everything, as it's sometimes called. So he orders Pope Benedict the 14th to investigate these Jesuits. King Joseph orders the Pope, "You must investigate them. They're cutting into our our coffers. We're not able to give you, the Pope, as much money as we could because our merchants aren't bringing back enough silver and gold." So that, of course, got the Pope's attention, but he didn't suppress them right off the bat, of course. Takes a while. It was September 3rd, 1758, where King Joseph of Portugal was almost assassinated. Almost, and that's the key thing. So King Joseph was having an affair with a baroness or a duchess, or Marchioness, something like the female version of a marquis. And her name, we know her name, was Teresa Lenor of Tavora. So Teresa Tavora was having an affair with the king of Portugal. So Teresa's husband, the Marquis of Tavora, he sends two hitmen to wait on the road down the way from the cottage where the king and his wife were enjoying some cocktails. So as the king is riding by in his carriage, two shots, arrows, I suppose, I mean, it could have been rifles, could have been guns. They take two shots at King Joseph, but they only graze him. He's not killed. Of course, the carriage races away, and the guy is saved. Now, here's enter into the Jesuit situation. Now, the Duchess, Teresa Tavora, being a royal family and being a Catholic, needs to have a good confessor. And guess what? Her confessor is a Jesuit, a guy by the name of Father Malagrida. Father Malagrida is Teresa Tavora's confessor. Actually, that same time when King Joseph was almost assassinated, Portugal experienced a huge earthquake. It practically destroyed Lisbon. And Father Malagrida was fond of saying, "This is God's punishment for our sins." Of course, that didn't sit too well with someone who's having too much fun in his side life, shall we say. So we got Teresa's father-in-law was the viceroy of India at the time. And this father-in-law, the dad of the husband, of course, was bitterly opposed to Pombel, Joseph's minister of everything. The story goes that Father Malagrida was very critical of course, the fair, and he tells her, "You got to stop having relations with the king." As a twist to the story, is she says, "Okay," she stops having an affair with the king, but she becomes she knows that the king just needs a good supply of young lady friends, so she becomes the kind of a royal pimp, as it were, and she finds a lot of girls for King Joseph. So anyways, that's going on back in Portugal. He's not getting enough money from the merchants bringing back stuff from the New World, so he's a little upset, and he's demanding that Pope Benedict XIV investigate the Jesuits, because they must be at the heart of the problem. Now there's this Pombel, this right-hand man of the king, emphasizes that the Jesuits are behind all this problem. As a matter of fact, he declares we must go and arrest the Jesuits. He actually arrests many of the families from Tavora, the members of Teresa's family. He tortures them, and he has Father Malagrida executed as a traitor and a heretic. How he was able to pin the rap of heretic on Father Malagrida is a bit mysterious, but isn't it interesting that he wanted to pin both the crime of being a traitor against the king and a traitor against the faith? Pope Clement XIII called Father Malagrida a martyr for the faith. So that charge of heretic was certainly not long-lasting, as it were, although he was still dead. The punishment was still long-lasting. So anyways, so we see that down in South America there, that there was this big dispute between Portugal and the Jesuits, but also between Portugal and Spain. They eventually kind of... Well, even before this, they had the line. Maybe you know this from history too. There was a dispute between Spain and Portugal about whose land, which country would rule over what new lands. And they said, "Well, let's get the Pope to help us decide this problem." So it's called the Treaty of Tordesillas, the Treaty of Tordesillas, and the line of demarcation. Now, the first line of demarcation was drawn on, the Pope must have gone to a map of the known world, which probably wasn't very good, of course. This is in 1493, and he draws a line that's like 300 miles west of some islands. I can't remember right now, but anyways, it just touches the tip of what is today present Brazil. So they hardly get any of the New World. Portugal gets everything east of that line, and Spain gets everything west of that line. Well, it just so happens that most all of South America was the west of that line. And so they dispute that. And a year later, we get the Treaty of Tordesillas. And so the Pope draws the line again, 1,000 miles west. So that's why Portugal is what it is today, because obviously the Portuguese settled what is now Brazil. Anyways, so not only were there was this dispute going on between the Jesuits and the king about the merchants and not getting enough money, but there was a dispute going on between Portugal and Spain. Things are always so complicated, right? So so here we go. Let's fast forward to this dispute. They do get the powers to be in Rome to get suspicious of the Jesuits. As a matter of fact, in France too, this spirit of nationalism or we want a state religion. All the French monarchs were in favor of a church controlled by the state. They didn't like this Pope being so independent and being able to tell us what to do, especially when we had our mistresses that we enjoyed so much and all the rest, because so many of the monarchs did have them. And if you had a Jesuit confessor, you would have to deal with him in a spiritual way. There was a cardinal in France by the name of Beaumont. Cardinal Beaumont was an outspoken critic of those who were criticizing the Jesuits. Cardinal Beaumont from France was saying, these guys are missionaries. They're bringing Christ to the new world, and they're holding to the sacredness of marriage and all the rest. And yes, the money may not be coming in as much as we could or would have it be if we kept slaves trading going on and all the rest. He was an incredible voice of reason and faith defending the right in that time. I guess what I need to say, too, if there's any bishops or cardinals listening today, we need strong and faithful cardinals and bishops to imitate Cardinal Beaumont, not many of the other cardinals who were too quick to go along with the cry to suppress the Jesuits, because the monarchs and the merchants were becoming filthy rich, shall we say. So here's an interesting line from Pope Clement XIII. Now, Pope Clement XIII was the one who dies kind of a confessor as the people were clamoring for the suppression of the Jesuits. He says, here we go, let's see, this was 1767, okay, so a little bit before he dies. Of all the blows that have wounded us during the 9 sorrowful years of our pontificate, the most painful to our paternal heart is the one which your majesty has announced to us. That is, that we're going to kick all the Jesuits out of... They're getting kicked out of France, getting out of Portugal. We attest before God and men that the body, the institution, the spirit of the Society of Jesus are innocent. Nay, that this society is not only innocent, but pious and useful and holy in its object, its laws, and its teachings. Well, it didn't really work because they were suppressed. Now, my friends, let's not make the same mistake. Let's strengthen the church with our wonderful doctrine, our wonderful history, a wonderful fidelity to Christ. I'm Father Tom Coase. You've been listening to Listener Supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
The world makes no sense. Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see? The winds have changed. Meaningless thought, the shell appears strong, but but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed.